Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I feel like I should say something other than sleepy because I always say sleepy, but I'm sleepy.
Well, it's your thing, it's your brand.
It's my brand. Oh, look at me. I'm
Yes.
tired. I'm yawning over here.
A brand is a promise.
I promise I will yawn and all kinds of stuff.
All kinds of stuff. Really, going out there the extra mile.
I'm gonna curl up with a pillow on the couch and look like I'm about to fall asleep.
Why are you tired?
I think it's
Just generally curious. What did you do?
it's one of those lack of activity tireds where
Oh.
if you just like sit still long enough, you just get tired.
Because your metabolism's low. Because you're not exercising. You're not doing some downward dogs. That whole yoga thing. You should do that.
I've never done a yoga thing, but we did just recently acquire the Wi-Fi password for the gym, so that's another false motivation that I can say will help me go to the gym more often that probably won't.
That was the major obstacle for
Well, you gotta have the Wi-Fi password. It's important to have Wi-Fi so you can hang out there and
Yeah, you can't get properly exercise without the internet.
Right, exactly. I mean, they have TVs where you can watch one of four given channels or whatever, one of which is like HGTV or something. Usually there's usually some flipping and flopping on while you're on the treadmill, but yeah, you gotta have Wi-Fi so you can Netflix or something.
Right.
Netflix from the recumbent bike chair. Yeah,
Okay.
I'd probably just get too comfortable and fall asleep again, just like watching movies anywhere.
Yeah, well, movies have an effect on people because movies are so boring. Guillermo del Toro movies like Hellboy, so dull. Nothing happens.
I mean, some stuff happens. It's just weird.
I'm gonna be perfectly honest. There's a lot of weird stuff that happens in Guillermo del Toro movies, but I always find that I get bored. And I don't know why it is. But yeah, there's just something about it where you're just like, if you're not on that ride, if you're not if you haven't hopped on that train, then by the time you get to the third act, you're like, I'm not here for this. Like whatever is happening right now,
Oh.
I can't piece together.
I forgot he was the Pacific Rim guy.
Yes. That one is really bad. Okay, let me be perfectly honest. I heard some people say, "Oh man, you have to watch this. It is so good." And it's like after all the bad reviews and stuff came out and it flopped at the box office, etc. They're like, "No, you don't understand." And so I rented it on iTunes because everybody was like, "Oh man, it's so good." And I watched it. I was like, "Oh my God. What is this? Like every scene is sort of a parody of what I imagine the original movie might have been because I can't piece together how this was made at all. And so I don't enjoy that. Now I know there are many Guillermo del Toro fans who will show up out of the woodwork and be like, "What? Like this is the most amazing thing ever." And like you don't understand his artistic blah blah blah. And I'll be like, "You know what?
All of
I
these people are
don't."
yelling at you while wearing steampunk top hats, aren't they?
Yeah, the steampunkiest.
I saw Pacific Rim. I saw it in the IMAX 3D theater over there at the City Walk thing, and then the LA there. And boy, was that not fun!
Did you see it in 3D?
Yeah,
Wow, big mistake.
it wasn't. I was tagging along. I saw it with our pal Sandy when I was working out there, and then I think the next day somebody brought up the movie and he said, "Oh yeah, for a minute I forgot that we actually saw a movie yesterday. It was that unaffecting."
Yeah, there's something to be said about having that much spectacle that moves you so not very much. I'm not sure what it is exactly. There's a lot of design and thought and effort that goes into it, and I don't doubt for a minute that there are many sleepless nights by.
There's a lot of rusted gears on things too.
Yeah, oh, so
Seems to
many.
be a trend of his.
So many rusted gears and weird swirly things and swoopy doos and stuff. Like I don't understand. But
What
yeah.
movie is he most known for? He got a lot of acclaim for Pan's Labyrinth, right? I didn't actually see that.
Yeah, well, my first Guillermo del Toro movie that I ever saw was Mimic. I didn't know it was his movie though, until much later.
I feel like I've seen part of that or something. Isn't it like a it's like Species, but it'll turn into stuff?
It's like cockroaches evolved to look like homeless people in the, yeah, so I don't, it's not a good movie. It's weird because there's this like, they evolved to look like they have trench coats and are unscrupulous people in the subways. It is a weird statement. But I don't remember the most of the rest of that. Blade 2, it was probably the one of his movies that I think I remember liking the most, but I haven't seen Blade 2 in probably 15-ish years. So
that was the one with the extravagantly used CG digital doubles who did lots of backflips like 30 feet in the air and stuff.
Yeah, and the jaws that split open, the Reapers.
Yeah, that was an interesting character design.
Yeah, because you see what happens is you get vampires. Vampires are boring. You know, you get your second movie, you gotta one up that. You gotta have your vampire's vampire.
You get really high one night and you go like, bro, what if there was like a vampire for vampires?
Yeah, and so
everyone goes like, whoa.
He did Blade 2, and then he did Hellboy after that. And I have no attachment or affinity for the materials that were composed by Mike Mignola about this. Like, I just.
It's a comic book, right?
Yeah.
Or graphic.
Yeah, Dark Horse. Yeah, Dark Horse comic book series. I don't know. People love it. I'm not one of them. But it's
an early attempt to mix some crazy fantasy sci-fi mysterious monsters world-ending stuff with some humor, getting a little Marvel-y at parts there with the jokey bits. And then this one, you know, I think what this was still in the era of when, you know, if you're going to make a superhero movie, you better make like you know one plot line that covers everything that you would need to know about these characters, because you may never get another one. Like, people weren't planning for trilogies right out of the gate, so there's so much in this movie that's like trying to like catch you up on everything that happens in the graphic novels and where people are and who's doing what and who loves who and monsters and, you know, squids from the sky and stuff, that it's just like, I don't know what I'm following here, and who's this guy with the weird parted hair and stuff.
Yeah.
Kind of all over the place, which, you know.
I mean, to give you some idea of how early on this is in the list of things that were going on, Spider-Man, the original Spider-Man was 2002. So that's not so many of the Spider-Mens. Like that.
When was Spider-Man 2? Because that was when they started adding like one too many bad guys, right?
Yeah, that was 2004, same year. So basically, if you were working on this, your idea of a superhero movie was whatever Tim Burton did with Batman, and then
CG.
Yeah, and then Bryan Singer's X-Men movie, and then Spider-Man by Sam Raimi. Like that's what you had for. Oh, and sorry, Superman the movie. And that series that was spawned after that, from the much earlier, but that's basically what you have to go on for where superhero movies were at the time. So, especially
and we still have our problem of the late 90s, early 2000s that we've talked about for the past couple of movies, of everyone just saying, put bigger and more in all of the movies and just keep going. Just keep, we don't need pacing, just put more stuff, all the stuff.
Yeah, so it kind of runs at a breakneck pace, but there is some character development in here. It is not as bad as some other movies where you're just moving from action set piece to action set piece. I especially like the comedic moments during the downtime that Hellboy has, where he's trying to figure out how to go after Liz, and also his jealousy over Liz's date. But
I thought that was amusing. I think Tambor was pretty well used, you know, in the beginning there when he's like haphazardly addressing the camera to assure everyone that the division doesn't exist. And then, you know, with the wooden match thing later.
Yeah, no, I like a well-deployed Tambor. we certainly had that in spades here. But, you know, Abe Sapien, I forgot from Having seen this so long ago and having seen the second one, I don't know, a few years ago, I thought that he played a more significant role in this picture, but he does not. I was like, wait, he gets incapacitated in the second act and that's it for the rest of the film?
He hangs out his little water tube thing most of the movie.
Yeah, that's sad. He's hanging out in his back to tank. Yeah, I quite like him, and it's Doug Jones, the somewhat famous actor who does all of the makeup stuff. So you see him a lot of the times, but you don't usually hear him, and that is the case here, where his voice is dubbed over, and you get the uncredited Niles Crane, David Hyde Pierce.
I thought I remembered that he was the voice of this, but then I looked briefly through IMDb and he wasn't there. And I was like, maybe I made that up somewhere.
No, David Hyde Pierce did the voice because the studio wanted him to. They liked him more than Doug Jones. But David Hyde Pierce didn't want to put his name on the movie because he felt like all of the performance was Doug Jones. So Doug Jones' name is on the movie, but that's not his voice.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Not really how credits work. You don't really get to like choose and stuff because it's unions, but
well, you can choose to go as uncredited. You can get your credits removed from something.
You can lobby for stuff like that, but like at least for like writing and stuff, like you don't really always get a choice for whether or not they credit you and how they credit you. Anyway, interesting. Yeah. I suppose. Yeah, Niles.
Yeah.
I enjoyed Niles.
Yeah.
But yeah, I also remembered him having a larger role in this than he did.
Yeah, I think he has a bigger role in the second one, but I could be mistaken because, like I said, that's been many years. But
I tried to remember the second one, and I just watched a little clip on the YouTube there to remind me of what happens. And then there's also a man in a suit who's made out of smoke. So they got the sand guy and the water guy and the red guy in this one. And then in the next one, there's a smoke guy who just sort of like blows up a suit like a balloon, and then like that's how he operates.
Yep. And that's Family Guy voice, Seth MacFarlane.
Is it really?
Yes.
Oh. I didn't remember that either. Hellboy. Yeah, so.
Mm-hmm. You got John Hurt, the recently, unfortunately, passed John Hurt.
Oh, right. That was him with the scruffy, the floofy white hair.
How do you not recognize John Hurt?
I don't know. He had glasses on and he had weird hair and like some beardy mustachey thing.
What do you have, Lois Lane syndrome? You can't recognize somebody when they have glasses on?
When they have glasses and like a half of a fro. Yeah, that's John Hurt.
Yes.
And then there was also a fella who played the young version of him in there, mm-hmm. in the World War II scene that I could barely hear the audio for.
Uh-huh.
They kind of launch right into a lot of different stuff. Like, there's a very long title card at the very beginning of this about something something, seven beasts of the something that can be unleashed and do something bad.
Yes, the Ogdru Jihad.
Is that what the clan of squids in the crystals in the sky is called?
Yes. The crystals in the skies with diamonds. Now, that, it was weird because it's hard to go from that to figure out what's happening because there's a lot of stuff that occurs where you need to know things that you never need to know again, or for a very long time in the film, at the very least. So with the Ogdru Jihad thing, the squid monsters that are inside of the crystals floating in space, it's not entirely clear whether that's 1/7 limbed part creature or if that's several creatures who make up one thing, because they only have one name but they're seven things. Anyway, it doesn't really seem to matter because there's also the question mark of what happens at the end of the film and he says that he brought a god back with him and then it lurches out of him and turns into a squid monster on the ground there, and it's like, well, technically, what is that thing? Because is that Ogdru Jihad number 8, or like what is that like exactly? Because that came out of nowhere. That was your Deus Ex Ras Mutant. I don't understand exactly the end of this film. But it supposedly had something to do with the beginning, because there's also opening the portal thing, and they've got a machine and stuff to do that, and it's like, yay, we finally did it. But then at the end of the film, they don't open a portal like that. They need to do it this other way, and it's like, well, but why? Like, unless the portal was just supposed to get you Hellboy, who opens the real portal. But that just seems like a really bad plan.
The real portal was inside of us all along. Yeah, no, it doesn't make any sense, because they make the portal, which appears to open just some random hole into space where you've got, I think it's multiple squid monsters within a single crystal. I don't know if that's one of the seven or if that's several of the seven, but there is more than one squid monster, and I'm not sure how if they're operating as one or something. But yeah, and then at the end there, they've just got their, it looks like a set piece from Azul's temple at the end of Ghostbusters. But it just shoots a light up in the sky at the moon, which maybe it turns the moon into the portal or something, and then squids come through there, or they start to come through the clouds, and then they turn into smoke poof, but also come out of his belly. But they very easily could have just made like the opening scene of this movie be the finale of a different movie. Maybe they're gonna do a prequel or something. They could prequel it up, because you know, this whole like quest for the portal to open it to save World War II. Like you're getting very close to like Captain America kind of thing there. Well, I guess then you would have a Hellboy movie without Hellboy. But like, you know, the opening scene is as dramatic or more dramatic than the ending scene of this movie, which is kind of weird.
Well, I think that's because the opening scene isn't as weird because things seem to be happening and you just take the character's words at face value, and that's supposed to be part of the universe building. So the universe building is that they say that they're opening this portal and that they need to destroy the portal and that'll block the thing from coming through, so they have to do it. But then at the end of the film, you're like, we have this totally different portal thing that we need you to open, but you came from the first portal, and we need you to do that in a certain way, except you didn't do it the way we wanted you to, and it collapsed. And so now I'm going to have a god that comes out and does something, because that's like plan C or D or whatever. And it's just like, this is not as engaging for me, because it feels like you're just changing the rules as you go along. Whereas at the beginning of the film, I'm much more willing to accept rules as you're setting them up than I am at the end of the film, where you're like, I'm just making new rules on top of the previous rules.
Yeah, it kind of depends. It's the thing about, like, yeah, the initial premise, you know, Nazis are losing the war, they're desperate, they're turning to these, you know, dark spiritual whatchahooza to unleash a demon or whatever to just destroy everyone. That, cool, I can get on board with that. Interesting concept, whatever.
Who can't get on board with that other than Indiana Jones?
You know, it's, again, that's also very Captain America-y, and that movie worked out better than this one, I think. But then, like, they're like, oh no, we thwarted the Nazis, and then the guy got sucked into the tiny hole, like the alien at the end of Alien Resurrection or whatever. And then Hellboy popped out, and then it's just like 25 years later. It's like, what, where, did we need to know anything important in there? Like,
well, Rasmutin gives her,
here's a book. You can find me. Yeah. You can find me anywhere in time with this book.
Yeah, look me up sometime. No,
it's his little black book of contacts. It's got all of his burner phone numbers in it.
It took her 25 years to find the right phone number. He gives her a book. He puts on his wacky glove, does the portal dance, gets turned into little golf balls of flesh and sucked in, and then...
Yeah, I didn't remember the glove thing controlling the portal, too. Like, I guess it's like a Nintendo glove or whatever, but I was looking at him, I'm like,
oh, glove.
He's got a big right hand like Hellboy. Did he somehow turn himself into Hellboy, or did he, like, manifest Hellboy because... He's got the glove thing, and then like through this weird portal thing, he ended up becoming a demon or something. I'm like, no, that's not what happened. That's just coincidence.
I think Mike Mignola just seems to have some sort of a giant hand fetish that I can't quite nail down. But
maybe he's got a lot of big things he needs to grab.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so
sorry, I apologize. This is supposed to be a family show, right?
Yes. 100% a family show. And so the weird thing, though, of course, is that he is counting on Ilsa and steampunk assassin droid guy to execute his plan.
The Sandman?
Yes, to execute his plan 25 years later by killing some random hiker and turning him into raspberry puree so that he can be resurrected from traveling beyond.
And again, this is another thing that like they glossed over in our opening scene, which I think could have been interesting in our prequel that doesn't have Hellboy. But like, he's somehow like worked his way into the top ranks of the Nazis, and then he's also become some like super powerful otherworldly being to the point that he's like, don't worry, no matter what happens, if I die, and like he's like, no matter what happens, so basically if I get shot, if a grenade blows me up, if I get sucked through a portal wormhole, doesn't really matter. Use this leather book, which is probably going to get ruined from all the rain, and you can say a prayer in some mountain somewhere and spill some guy's blood and some swirly lines in the ground, and then like I will rise out of a hole. That seems to be a pretty interesting power that could be explored and should be, but it's not. He's just like, you know, whatever. I went through the hole and I saw some devil beings and I am immortal now or whatever. Or he's not immortal. You just bring him back from the dead or something. I don't know. Unclear, but he's able to be resurrected. And then he can resume his plans to invite giant squids to come destroy Earth.
Yeah, see, okay, so a couple things to unpack there. When he hands her the book in the rain, and we get that close-up shot of the book totally being rained on, love that close-up shot.
Also, why is he not wearing a shirt? He's wearing a big fur coat in the rain. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he if he got it flaunted, I guess. But so anyway,
he's like, I might die tonight. I'm going to wear my flyest outfit to the devil unleashing party.
Yes, the devil needs to see my abs. So he kisses Ilsa on the forehead and says, you're going to be immortal and young and beautiful forever and stuff. And it's like, I feel like this is just something that you are saying so that we don't have to recast this role for 25 years later and then try to figure out who it is. I think you just wanted to keep the same actress. But now
they would pick somebody in their late 30s and then just digitally de-age them for the opening scene.
Yeah, but see, the weird thing is he does this thing where he's like, I'm making you immortal, okay, ta-ta, and it's like, what? There wasn't an effect, there wasn't an incantation.
He touched
your
forehead with his thumb, Joe. That's what, yeah. What do you need?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, we get back to the hand thing again, I guess, but so he does that. She's holding on to the totally soaking wet book now, and he conjures up the gyroscope portal. Then they get attacked by the allied guys, and the thingy blows up and things go awry, and the assassin guy who was stabbed disappears. And
for today, I've never even heard the word para-abnormal. As if like magic was suddenly invented in 1940.
Yeah, well, he could have just been the simple guy from Kansas.
I'm just
or something.
A down home fella from Nebraska. Came here to Scotland in the rain to fight the Nazis.
Yeah, I mean, as you do. It was the style of the time, but
it was the draft of the time.
Yeah. No. See, the thing is that I actually like the beginning of this film,
except for all of the exposition that we're supposed to remember that doesn't have anything to do with anything, right?
Well, but see, that's the thing. I like that, but then as we go on, I feel like they squandered tying that in tightly to things that happen later.
And well, yeah, so, like the only things they take from the opening scene through the rest of the movie are immortal Rasputin guy, sky squids, and opening a gate or a portal or a light or a thing.
Yeah, and his immortal assistants and Hellboy coming to Earth, being tied with the opening of the portal.
To be completely honest, I didn't even notice that blonde lady didn't age, because that was one of the things that I probably glossed over him saying when he was touching her forehead with his thumb. I missed the like you'll be immortal thing, so I didn't realize she was supposed to be.
Yeah, well, he's,
I mean, she was young at the end, but like I didn't realize that was a thing he did.
He's like whispering it. I didn't catch it at all the first time I watched the film, and I was like, why is she fine and still like there? What happened?
I cared so little about her. It didn't even register with me. Like, hey, she should be a lot older, like John Hurt was.
Yeah, she's not a character, really. Sorry, Ilsa.
Well, she's a air quotes character. She's very emotive. Not necessarily in a good way.
No, she's a minion. She does minion stuff.
She
nothing.
She pontificates about how great her boss is.
Yeah, and then she's like, "Oh, you know, hell has no surprises for us." At the end, it's like, "Well, good sign off." That
I'd be like, "Bro, yeah. I'm immortal. I'm taking off. So later."
Yeah,
peace. I don't want to get hit with a squid leg.
Yeah, sorry that Calamari disagreed with you, but no.
Yeah, heyo.
Yeah, I don't like Calamari, by the way. But. There's just something about the texture, but there's the whole thing with Samael, the resurrection dog, and
Hellhound.
Yeah, so here's your gatekeeper keymaster thing, where he was inside of a statue, and they bring him out, and he's tearing up a museum, and they're the most. There's the highest number of people I've ever seen standing around outside of a museum ever. At the opening of this museum scene where they approach, like,
you mean when the trash truck shows up with the double sided mirrors?
Yeah, and they have the live TV broadcast of like, oh, somebody set off an alarm inside the museum. It's like, why would that be a live broadcast? Why would there be anyone there? Because it's a museum and it's nighttime. Like, nothing's happening.
Maybe this community is it really gets into the arts, and
it's New York, Dan.
Oh. What year is it supposed to be?
Well, it's far enough along that we still have payphones, apparently. So.
Right, it's like 70s or 80s, right?
No. I think it's supposed to be modern day of 2004.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, there were payphones in 2004?
I mean, there's still payphones now somewhere.
Nebraska.
Yes. Where you can never hear about Paranormal. But so anyway, this opening also gives us the worst part of the first act, which is our introduction to Kersmillis Myers, who I feel, you know, I just he did not work.
Who, the kid?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why he was there.
Yeah.
I know why he was there, because John Hurt was going to die and they needed somebody to take over the division of, let's just call them Division of Tasty Pies, because I can't remember what they're called.
This is the BPRD.
The what?
BPRD.
The BPRD, that's a
terrible
acronym. Bureau
of Paranormal Research and Defense. Not to be confused.
I'm going to go with Tasty Pies or Tasty Nachos or whatever, because there's a lot of chili and nachos in this. But, like, you know, then they have, like, John Hurt die, and then Tambor's in there kind of, like, screaming, doing his, no, I'm the boss, you need to respect me, I'm the boss. And he says it so many times, you're like, all right, we get it, you're about to be shown up because you're out of your league, because that's how these movies work. But, yeah, it's like, why is he here if we've got Tambor? Is that, well, I guess he's there to sort of throw that very peculiar wrench in the mix of the love between Hellboy and Liz, and who likes who, and aw shucks, you know, I just want you to be happy even if you like the stupid human because he makes you feel human thing.
Yeah.
I guess you kind of have to, like, explore that subplot of, like, oh, if this was what you looked like and this is what you were pulled into a human's world, how would you cope with not really being able to fit in and stuff? I guess for character empathy or something, but it was just weird.
My main objection to him is that they would bring in somebody who had no familiarity nor interest with the work that they were doing. Where is your Fox Mulder? Like, I'm sure there's someone in the FBI who's like at least read a little bit more than this guy on the paranormal.
They should have given him a partner, like a buddy cop who's like super into conspiracy theories.
Well, I mean,
he could be the Scully.
He's sort of loosely paired with Clay, who he's supposed to be kind of replacing ish, sort of.
But we don't know anything about Clay other than Clay has hair plugs.
Yeah,
which is weird. Why does that come up more than once?
I don't know. You really think it looks like doll hair? Yeah, I don't know why that kept coming up, but it's just that he's he's a drip. So he's not very interesting for us. And he's supposed to be, as the audience, he's supposed to be our view into this world, because he knows so little of what's happening that everything needs to be explained to him, which is us, in the audience.
Look how wacky this world is. I don't even know how to deal. But then he deals pretty quickly. Like, you guys aren't even going to go in there and fight with him. You guys are crazy. I'm going to go in there and fight with him. And everyone's like, dude, you shouldn't do that. Because, I mean, if you were a human like the rest of us, you'd be kind of freaked out by all of these things. And that's another one of the things, like, of all of the things that it does sort of, you know, give us some moments to breathe in between the scenes. Like, he goes right from, like, hey, you're hired, to, like, oh, there's a giant dog monster thing we got to go kill now, and let's chase that around and stuff. And I don't know. He went from 0 to 100 pretty quick, which, I mean, his 100, he went from 0 to like 10, which is about where he maxed out in this movie.
He has no specific capability or skill or charisma or anything interesting about him.
He's just the smartest guy in the academy that they could get to bring bowls and buckets of chili to Hellboy.
Yeah, and as things are going on and he's supposed to be more competent and interesting, he isn't. He just kind of does what he needs to do for the role. But he shows no... He shows no real learning or skill. He just kind of just does things. So, like, by the end, when he is getting out of his shackles and picking up the rosary in the snow to throw it to Hellboy, it's like, where was this particular aspect of our character before this point in the film? Because it was not there. Like, we didn't establish he was super good at throwing things. We didn't establish that he had any sort of super interest in the rosary. We didn't establish the specific relationship of the rosary to Hellboy, other than the opening scene where the young version of John Hurt is trying to hand out rosaries. So when he catches that rosary and the cross burns his hand, he's like, oh no, what am I doing? Blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay, so he precipitated the change in direction of the end of the picture. So he's integral in that respect. But what precipitated that change is nothing that came from any sort of character growth with him. Like, it's just, yeah, he just needed to do it at that point in the film so that Hellboy could go back to being cool.
Yeah, there's a scene missing after the funeral where... John Myers talks to Hellboy and tries to, like, console him and, you know, don't forget that he was your guiding light or whatever. He was your father and believed in you, that you could be something, blah, 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 better, whatever. But they just go from, like, Hellboy standing on top of the thing, very conspicuously, by the way, like, he's only, like, 10 feet above everyone else, so I'm not sure why he was up there, to, like, he hasn't come out of his room for 3 days or whatever, and then, like, they never really have a moment where, like, they sit down and go, like, hey, man, it's probably rough that you lost, like, your father figure kind of thing. So that was a missed opportunity for character development. And then, like, yeah, in terms of, like, him being competent, like, after Rasputin does his thumb on the forehead thing with Liz and, like, makes her set the building on fire or whatever, we're led to believe that he's, like, best and the brightest in his class or whatever, but he doesn't realize that the big red... 20-year-old Hellboy who's in love with Liz might be a little butthurt that you took his girlfriend out on a coffee date without telling anyone. Like, that's you didn't think that might come up later as, like, a potential issue, but you're supposed to be smart guy. I didn't buy that he was so, like, oh, what do you, I don't know, I'm just the liaison here, I, you know, this, what do you mean, yeah, I guess she's a pretty girl and I'm taking her out on a date, why would he have a problem with that?
I don't love the angle they tried to take with him for the love triangle.
They didn't even push it hard enough to know that, like, to know if he was, like, really trying to do that or if he's just trying to be, like, good friend pal. They just leave him in sort of just, like, gray, non-threatening, I'm too stupid to know what's going on around me area.
Yeah, see, that is what I was going for, is that they tried to sort of play it both ways where he is a threat to Hellboy, but not really. And he's the person who brings Liz back, but is sort of interested, but not really interested. And then, like, if he got together with Liz, or if Liz got together with Hellboy, then, like, nothing would be a big deal for him. And it's like, he has no personal stake in any of the things that are occurring. And that's also why that scene is missing that you were describing, where we see him talk to Hellboy.
Says that Hellboy outside your door.
There are a bunch of dogs for some reason losing their ish right now, and I don't understand what that's about. Anyway, so
are they Samael dogs?
Hopefully not. That'll really do something for property values. But he doesn't have that scene because they need to maintain the tension of the love triangle into the mausoleum, because that's one of the moments where they're like listening to the ground and hears them talking about him, and it's like, oh, do you really think this is a good time to talk about this? And it's like, yeah, sure. Like, are you really interested in him? Are you interested in me or whatever? And it's like, why? Why is that there? Like, I understand.
Well, you've also got that scene where Liz walks by and he like walks out into the hallway and puts his hands awkwardly in his pockets and stares at her. It's like, oh, this is as far as we're going to push the he's interested in her line. Like, he doesn't ever say anything like, you know, I understand that it must be difficult to, you know, try and fit in, and, you know, you can do it better than they can, and you just want a normal life. I get it. Because, you know, that's her whole thing in the beginning there. She's in that rehab facility to try and learn how to not set people on fire accidentally and live a normal life like a human. But, They don't really explore her very much. I guess, I mean, how much more exploration could they do of the characters when they've got all this other nonsense to do? Although they probably could have cut some of the nonsense out.
Yeah, well, they could have just dealt with that as part of the story, rather than just making it a continuing thing that's supposed to last until the third act, where it is part of a thing that he overhears, but then doesn't come up in the final scenes of the film. I don't know if you noticed, but once they're captured by Ilsa and Rasputin and chained up and stuff.
Ilsa and Rasputin.
Yeah, well, that's what they do.
Yeah, terrible.
And so they get all shackled up and stuff, and then it basically amounts to, no, don't open the portal. No, remember who you are. Here's the rosary I'm going to throw to you. Okay, I'm going to watch over her while you go back and save everybody. Here's the grenade thing. I didn't get you anything. Oh, funny comment. How big could it be? Blah blah blah. That is the extent of their conversation at the end of the film. That's it. Like, they don't resolve really the tension of the love triangle. We know though that Selma Blair obviously has feelings towards Hellboy more so than Myers. And that's expressed in that final moment, but nothing is resolved between Hellboy and Myers. They just kind of, that was it.
Well, he's such an aw shucks G kind of guy that once he sees that Liz has chosen Hellboy, he'll just bow out gracefully.
Sure, but that wasn't depicted anywhere.
No, it's just to be assumed because he's a potato and he doesn't have any emotions.
Yeah, poor potato.
I enjoy potatoes.
Yeah, he wasn't in the sequel to this, though. What does that tell you?
That he was a potato and he was useless to the plot. I don't know what to tell you, man. Who was in charge of the crew in number two?
What do you mean, the director?
No, like the
casting.
The Department of Tasty Pies. Who was in charge of the Department of Tasty Pies?
I thought Tambor came back.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I didn't want to try and look for it on
okay, good talk.
IMDb here while we're doing that. All right, here it is, Hellboy 2. Let me see if Tambor is in here.
This is exciting.
Oh, wait, this is a prologue, so this is something else. This is not the sequel movie. It's also called the same thing.
Oh, wow, prologue, that's good.
Mm-hmm. Seth MacFarlane, there's Tambor. Okay, so he's there. Wait, John Hurt's in the second one too? Must be some more unnecessary arbitrary flashbacks, because there were those in this movie too.
Yeah, flashbacks.
Somebody played somebody named Agent Steel. Is that you?
No.
Is it the novelization, the graphic novelization of your life?
No. I can't say that I've licensed that material.
Well, you're a public figure, so people can write biographies about you all they want. It's an unauthorized Steel biography.
What does that mean? Is it like conflict minerals? Like, what do you mean an unauthorized Steel biography?
You're a human conflict mineral.
Okay, so anyway. Right.
So they we got the opening scene, there's a portal, things go wrong, Hellboy comes out, fast forward 20 years, there's the Department of Tasty Pies. Hellboy is helping beat up monsters, because apparently monsters are a frequent enough thing that they had to just start the Department of Tasty Pies to battle them. You know, the Gozer demon thing is in the museum, and they fight it.
No, Dan.
What?
I'm gonna stop you right there.
What?
Gozer was the god that came through the gate.
Right, I'm Gozer's dog, I should say, not Gozer the dog.
Should sell that PBS series.
Oh, yeah. What, Zool?
Yes, Zool and Friends.
Zool and Friends. Okay, so the Zool dog is in the museum, but then it escapes, and they shoot a tracking beacon into it, which is green, but then it also bleeds glowy green blood, so they just follow it that way. And it also uses a tongue thing, kind of like the blade vampires, to bite Hellboy, to put a little thing on him, and it implants an egg in his arm. So you learn that it has eggs, so it can have more Gozer dogs or more Zool dogs. And then
life finds a way.
Life finds a way. They track it to the subway station, and then he's wrestling with it, and it turns out you can't kill it because it just revives itself or whatever. So then he just grabs a hold of it and then touches the third rail and electrocutes it, and it turns into smoke. And then there's a cutaway to. When Rasputin created it in the first place out of this jar of salt of angel tears or whatever that held the hell dog captured. So he rehydrates the dehydrated hell dog and says, if you die, two more will rise from the ashes. That's it's pretty common fantasy demon trope kind of thing, right?
It's your real hydra trope.
Yeah, exactly. It's a hydra trope. So again, this is precursor to Captain America. You know, Captain America is just
tale
a rip off of Hellboy.
As time. What?
It's Captain America is really just a rip off of Hellboy, isn't it?
No, I feel like it has more Indiana Jones DNA in it than Hellboy DNA.
Hmm. Gross.
Yeah. Well, I mean, have you seen Indiana Jones? So anyway, the having recently watched Indiana Jones and the Rocketeer. I've Joe Johnston, the director of both of those, has a different style than Guillermo del Toro does. Of course, Steven Spielberg, doing the Indiana Jones movies, has a different style. So yes.
Speaking of Spielberg,
This is not Spielbergian at all.
Right. No, just quick side tangent. I watched a little bit of Lost World, second Jurassic Park movie.
I'm familiar. That was the first bad Spielberg movie I ever saw.
Right. I was watching it. I'm like, wow, this is a bad movie. Who did they get for the second one of these? Because I know the third one is, what's his name?
Joe Johnston.
Yeah. And then I looked it up and it was Spielberg. I'm like, this looks like a Spielberg parody because you've still got the depth staging of characters and the scenes and stuff, but it's just like they put him in these, like, your set is 10 feet by 15 feet, so you can't really play around with the staging of the characters in any particularly interesting way. So you're just going to put somebody 6 inches from camera and somebody 20 feet from camera and just do some rack focuses and have people slide in and out of frame. It's like, what is this movie? Anyway, I digress.
I think the camera choices are not my biggest problem with Lost World.
No, there's a lot of them. There's a lot of bad CG in there too.
There's a lot
of bad acting.
A big book of problems for Lost World.
There's Vince Vaughn. Anyway, so he fries the hell dog. Well,
remember that accent that what's her face was doing, Julianne Moore.
Yeah, Julianne Moore, I don't know who she was pretending to be in that movie, but it wasn't...
It wasn't good.
It wasn't an actor.
No.
It turns out that in Back to the Hellboy, the Abe Sapien fella can touch a thing that was in a room and play back the scene like a security camera, which, I mean, I guess they probably just could have watched the security camera in the first place because it's a very, very fancy museum. But they felt the need to do it psychically, with touching things and then imparting memories like Spock or something. But yeah, you saw that Rasputin said you can't kill this guy because when you kill him, two more are gonna pop up. And then they also, so like, not only will he revive himself if you kill him, and when he revives himself from being really killed, there'll be two of him, but he also lays eggs, so there's just gonna be all kinds of hell dogs all over the place, which you would think that would be enough of like a maybe it just wasn't a fast enough way to take over the world for Rasputin. A bunch of hell dogs running around killing people, because there were a lot of eggs that they laid there shortly after this. But he also wants to do sky worms or sky squids. But basically they're like, wow, it only bit you and it was on you for like 5 seconds and it implanted three eggs in you. It probably implanted some eggs wherever you were chasing it to, because it was out of your sight for a little while and it's looking for dark, quiet, moist places. And, you know, there's the subway for that. And, oh, by the way, this just so happens to be a section of the subway where a bunch of lines intersect with like a cistern or something. So this is going to be a dark, moist, quiet place for them to lay a bunch of eggs. And of course, there's a bunch of eggs. And then Abe goes swimming and gets clawed up by one of the two things. And then he just like escapes. And then all of the Department of Tasty Pies regular people get eaten. And even Clay with his hair plugs, he gets killed. And
but he's killed by a Clockwork Nazi.
Yeah, Clockwork Nazi also lives down there, because I don't know, maybe he just likes the darkness and moisture, even though, because he's made out of sand and stuff.
Yeah, but his lair has a little in furnace thing or something. It was weird,
right? So he's got his mixture of like cold and moist and warm and dry, so he can be like right in between. He can regulate his internal humidity as he sees fit.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's a knob for that. Now. That was supposed to be a more dramatic scene than I feel like it was, because the geography was so confusing. There are at least two Samael that we know about, because we saw the little green blob split over the dead one, and you know the whisper of there two in your place. But and then we saw all the eggs. But then when Abe is attacked, it's by one, and then up above the agents deal with two. But then Hellboy is fighting another one, and we don't know how they're getting around so much, especially when Hellboy and that one fall down, like, I don't know, 10 stories or something underground. Remember when they fall down that shaft?
Yeah, they're on the tracks, but then they fall down a 10-story tunnel and then land in a subway station.
Yeah.
So that's, I don't know, maybe it's like a loop. Maybe it goes to the center of the Earth and then loops back out because of gravity and something.
I don't know. The New York subway system is a mess. But
is that how gravity lensing works? Is that what that was?
No, I think though some subway stations are further down than others. But I couldn't imagine how that would be the case in this particular way, because it seems like that's really far from the other one that was there before. But who knows? Who could say? I have no idea. But that's what I mean by the geography of how this fight is happening is very confusing, because we're supposed to be keeping track of the agents from the department, and we're supposed to be keeping track of Abe, and we're supposed to be keeping track of Hellboy, and we're supposed to also be keeping track of Clockwork Nazi. But they all seem to be doing different things in different directions and popping between different locations. Like when Hellboy goes back to where they were before, all of a sudden he's just back there and he finds Clay.
Oh yeah. How did he get back up the hole?
Yeah, we don't know. He went back up 10 stories of whatever.
He jumped real high.
Yeah, and then he calls for a medic. And then the next scene, they're all safely out of there. All the survivors are safely out of there.
Right, but don't forget that Clockwork Nazi killed Clay and then, like, took out his little knob to, like, pretend to be dead. So, like, I guess if his knob is in, he has a pulse or whatever. It seems like he could just lay down and be like, oh, I'm dead. I died, because you can't tell because I'm made out of sand.
Yeah, but see, the other thing is we also don't have a resolution for what happened to the other Samael, because if there were two and he took out one, where did the other one go?
Back in the water to protect its eggs? Like he just like ran away, basically, is what I was left to believe.
Yeah, but then they extracted Abe from the scene, because there was also one lurking behind him, but then somehow they got him out safe, and then supposedly I guess they destroyed all the eggs and stuff and other one off camera or something.
I don't think they did. I think they left them.
But that doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't make any sense. Like, they've royally failed at this mission in all regards, except, like, the only thing good that came out of it...
Except.
Actually, mm-hmm. nothing good came out of the scene for the good guys. The only thing that came out of the scene for the bad guys is that Sand Nazi, Clockwork Nazi, was able to infiltrate the Department of Tasty Pie so he could kill John Hurt.
Yeah, and...
if somebody tuned in halfway to this episode, I'm really sorry, because none of this is going to make any sense.
No, well, too bad.
Clockwork Nazi infiltrating the Department of Tasty Pies.
Yeah, and then you also have the whole thing with Selma Blair, where the whole reason why she blew up the thing, because Rasmussen wanted her to. There's a cool cut of that, by the way, where the security guard comes in to check on her and then closes the door, and then from the shadow immediately comes Rasmussen.
Yeah, it's nice.
I like that. That's a cool touch. Sorry.
Yeah. Just quick question. Do we know why he did that? Like, was she supposed to be some like integral part of the plan? Like, he needed Fire Girl to like do one of the steps of the Gozer mausoleum at the end there that we just never got to.
No, he needed her to be a distraction for Hellboy, him to be able to pull off the rest of his complicated, convoluted plan. He says as much to John Hurt later on when they're face-to-face. Because also, Rasputin has these teleporting powers, presumably from coming back from the other side. You know, hello from the other side. Must have met 1,000 times. Anyway, so he...
Adele Rasputin?
Yes. And he also has the worst sunglasses I've ever seen. Ever?
They're pretty bad.
I mean, where did you buy those sunglasses, Rasputin? The Matrix? I don't understand that. Those are awful. Those are atrocious. I demand a refund for those sunglasses. He
got them at like the knockoff Sunglass Hut kiosk at the local mall.
Yes. Shade Glass Shack. That's where he got them. But. So he tells her to destroy the thing so that way she can go back with them and be a distraction for the stuff. And
that's pretty I'm just gonna say it's a dumb plan, because he unleashed another powerful we don't call them mutants. What are they in this world? Just like powerful thing beings, whatever? We don't really know where she got her power. She just like was a kid and lost control and burned people and stuff, but He unleashed a powerful fire mutant into the battlefield under the assumption that that would be more of a distraction for Hellboy than a benefit to Hellboy fighting back.
Yes, that was the assumption.
Dumb, risky, bad move.
Yep. But, I mean, it does get him 50% of the way through the weird lock he gets for some reason at the end of the film. So he plays the distraction angle where the creepy guy who doesn't have lips or eyelids
pretty terrifying.
Yeah, it's not a good look. Who has mutilated himself in the quest for surgical perfection.
That angle I did not particularly need. He got addicted to plastic surgery, and now look at him now. He has arm sword knife things, and he can't die because he's made it out of sand and stuff. It's like, is this some sort of like weird commentary on like Orange County moms addicted to plastic surgery?
No,
or something.
He didn't say plastic surgery, he said addicted to surgery.
Like, what are we supposed to assume that means? Like,
no, it wasn't.
Was the point of the surgery to turn him into like spiritual demon, or is just like I want to be better at swinging swords and stuff?
It was the latter, because obviously it wasn't plastic surgery, because he didn't want to look good. That was not the point of what he was doing. So he wanted to be a super assassin, unkillable super assassin. And for the most part, that kind of works for him. He looks gross. That's why he's always wearing his Lululemon jumpsuit and face mask.
Well, because he's made out of sand. He's sand inside of an Edgar suit. He just like he'll sand out on the floor if you slice him.
Yeah, you don't want to have that happen.
I sense that was a pun, but I didn't understand.
It was Dune, but but it was a contraction, so it didn't really work.
Sand duned.
So
you just got Scottish for a second. You don't want that to happen.
Is it like not really Scottish so much as like Willie the groundskeeper? But so they they have him go and do the stuff where he's threatening the professor, because now Abe is disabled. Hellboy is out of there, and Agent What's His Face is out on a date with Claire. Liz. And so they have him all to himself, except for, you know, he could call for help or something, I suppose. But anyway, they explain their evil plan, and then it's like, for raising my son, I will show you my vision of the future. And shows him the destroyed city and squid tentacles from the sky.
And, you know, if they were going to, like, I don't know if it would have been better or worse. Maybe they shot it and they cut it out. But, like, they could have done, like, a, you know, Hellboy, you were out being a nosy, jealous boyfriend instead of being here, and you could have protected your dad kind of thing. They could have used that for some emotional resonance, but they didn't. They're just like, you know, he comes back and he's sad and he hugs the dead body, which is surrounded by those little evidence number cards for no reason whatsoever, because it's not like there's machine gun shells all over the floor or something. But yeah, and then the Rasputin claiming Hellboy as his son, like, did he know, like, why would he have known that Hellboy came through? Because that wasn't, like, the goal of his portal scene in the beginning there. Well, he just wanted sky squids.
That's what I mean, though, is, like, I don't know if that was the original goal, if he knew that portal was actually just to bring Hellboy to bring the sky squids.
Oh, so the plan A, like, the step one of the plan is bring Hellboy through the portal, even though, like, when he opens the portal, we see the sky squids in the crystals. And then step one, bring him through the portal. Step two, go to Russia to, presumably, wait 20 years so his hand's big enough to fit in the gozer hole.
Yeah. And also, you have to have that monolith that the Ogduru Jihad apparently sent him, which is the line that he says. He says, "This is, you know, the
crystal squids are the Ogduru Whatchahooses."
Yeah, yeah. They sent that marble thing that with the holes in it and the glyph on it.
Did they send it USPS or something? Like, how did they send it?
I don't understand. Like, it's just some line that he drops that is from from them. And it's like, well, how could it be from them? Like, how do things get anywhere these days? Like, I don't understand.
Where was it, and who built the bloody swirly ground thing that brought him back to life? Like, it's an ancient temple somewhere in the snow, but, like, we don't know whose it is or where it is or what it was built for, or, like, how come you were able to bring him back without filling all of the swirly ground things full of blood? You only filled two of the four or something. There was nothing. Like, we could have explored some of that. Like, it would have taken another, like, 2 minutes maybe.
I didn't really need it to be explored so much as I just needed it to make sense.
Just integrate it some, like, maybe that's also the place in Russia with the marble thing that the squids mailed him.
Yeah.
Couldn't it be the same place? Like, why would that be so hard?
I don't know. Hellraiser did it. I don't understand why it's so complicated for this movie. They have to have, like, a new set piece every 5 minutes.
It's probably it's in the comic book.
Could be. I haven't read it, but it just in the film it doesn't seem to make any sense. I am given to understand, though, from fans of the comic, that the film doesn't necessarily hew closely towards the graphic novel at any particular point. The comic series at any particular point. So they just kind of just do whatevs. So there's another weird thing, though, with the mausoleum at the end. It's like, part of the plan was that he was going to leave his piece of paper to draw them to the mausoleum so that they'd be able to take advantage of the situation. Again, this is really complicated. And they draw them in there. They have set up a special thing that triggers a maze that has a bridge that has a special dangly hammer thing that smashes the bridge thing. They have another route that the other ones are all taking, and they're all supposed to get together for some sort of meaningful thing or whatevs. And with Hellboy, he has to face off with Jeffrey Tambor against the Clockwork Nazi guy in his lair that's just inside of the mausoleum, because he just has these lairs apparently scattered everywhere. And So they fight, and then there's a pit and stuff, and then they throw him in, and they put a cog on top of him, giant cog.
Yeah, he's probably not dead. He's probably just stuck down there because he can't get out.
Yeah, and then it leaves Jeffrey Tambor there, and then goes and punches his way down to where Liz and Myers are, where they're dealing with this MIL, which I got a question. How did they get from New York to Moscow?
I mean, probably an airplane.
Did they buckle up? Like, what exactly is the transport medium for these?
It was probably a fake trash airliner made out of double-sided mirrors.
Okay.
I have no idea.
Okay, yeah, but that's my thing. It's like, I don't understand how that happened. And it's not really a plot point other than the fact that those are his minions from earlier in the film, so they need to show up at the end of the film, and the end of the film needs to take place in Moscow for some reason. So that they need to be there. And so they are. And then they do the thing where Liz blows everything up with her firepower.
I didn't like that she made stupid parted hair kid slap her to get her anger up or whatever, because the whole point of her like rehab thingy was that she was able to control it and stuff, but then she apparently can't bring it on command. So she says like, "Hit me and I'll go crazy and set everyone on fire."
Yeah, my recollection is she can control it much better in the second film. But anyway, she causes the big explosion thing, and then she passes out, and then Myers is Dunzo from the big old thing, and Ilsa and Rasputin are like, "Oh, look at this! This is exactly what we planned." It's like, "How did you plan this? How do you plan that? Like, what complicated flowchart did you diagram out where you were like, I'm pretty sure this is exactly what is going to happen?" But nonetheless, here we are.
It's IFTS. If this, then Samael.
And then there's also the issue of Samael, where they're like, our whole plan is to just blow them up, because if we blow them all up at the same time, then we'll destroy them all and they won't respawn. And I'm like, but that's what happened when there was only one of them. You blew them all up, technically, because there was only one. So then how is this a different plan? Because they are setting them on fire with her firepower, whereas the first one was on fire from the third rail energy flowing through him.
Well, her fire is blue and it's a lot stronger fire. Oh, so yes. it burns the methane poof that comes out of the Samael's also.
Oh, right. That's right. And they set their spirit on fire. So they don't have any more Samaels now after this point, I guess.
Samael zero.
Yeah, except when they cut to the end credit scene where Jeffrey Tambor is still inside of the lair area. And
was there an end credit scene? I gotta keep watching these movies to the end credits.
Yeah, well, I mean, you don't gotta. I mean, it was just Jeffrey Tambor going, Guys, you guys gonna come back and get me? And then
that
all of a sudden,
funny.
Yeah, and all of a sudden there was like a noise, you know, from the thing, and that was it. That's your funny laugh riot thing. So then it's like, was that a Samael, or was that like Ivan who was knocked off of the bridge? Is he clawing his way back up? Is he making noises?
Maybe it's just something else that lives down there.
Maybe. I mean, guy like that probably has a lot of weird crap in his basement.
Well, his basement is like friggin' Narnia. It's like a whole world down there. So maybe there's just like, you know, indigenous life and stuff.
Yeah. How exactly does one build that?
Well, step one, buy mausoleum. Step two, dig 300 square miles of space below and build ruins and bridges and Maze Runner stuff under there. I don't know.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
Oh, wait. Magic. Sorry, magic is the answer. He can teleport. Maybe just like teleports to the quarry, grabs a rock, teleports back, and builds it, and he can just go real fast.
Yeah, teleport yourself to the lair you want, lair you have.
Maybe his teleportation skills are like jumper, so he'll teleport to like ancient Rome and then just like hug a building, and then he'll jump it back inside of his mausoleum. So he just takes the whole building.
Okay. I never saw Jumper.
Oh, come on.
Don't come on me. It wasn't like it was like some critically acclaimed film that I missed out on.
It's so terrible. You have to see it, though. We should talk about it sometime. It's boy, you thought he was bad in the Star Wars movies.
He's still not selling me on this.
It's got Rachel Bilson in it.
It's still not sold on this.
And who plays his mom? Samuel Jackson has white hair in it. Well, it's kind of silver hair.
Okay.
Silver. Yeah. Oh, Diane Lane. She's in there.
Poor Diane Lane.
And then, Kristen Stewart has, I think she says the word hello, and that's all she says in the movie.
Was it me you're looking for? Now,
Jamie Bell is in there. He's an actor, apparently.
It was something else that we saw one time.
Was he?
I think so.
Oh, he looks like a Game of Thrones-er. Is he a Game of Thrones-er?
Maybe. I don't know. None of these are material facts in this case.
Oh, he was in Snowpiercer.
Ugh. Oh, that's what it was. I remember because we watched that, and you commented on Jamie Bell, who was in that thing, and then you talked about how bad Jumper was.
Jumper is, yeah, I mean, you gotta see Jumper. It's you got David S. Goyer writing, you got Doug Liman directing. It's Ooh. Just it's the cream of the crop.
No, return that crop. Just get rid of it. That crop is bad.
I mean, that would be easy to do if you were a jumper. You could just jump somewhere and then put the crop down and then jump back.
Okay. So anyway,
where were we?
At the end of this film.
Well, they burned up all the Samael's and blacked out, and then blonde lady's like, just as we had planned, and you were like, how did you plan that?
Yeah. And so they're like, yeah, so we stripped Liz naked and put a cloth on her and then put her on top of this altar, and if you cooperate with us, we'll let you live in our new world, which will be a paradise, a new Eden for you, and then if you don't, we'll take her soul. And the only way you'll get it back is if you open the portal to the other side.
And then he's like, no, I'm not going to do it. So they suck her sapphire soul out of her mouth, and then he's like, fine, give her back and I'll do it. But he's in like a wooden board with the thing that says his true devil name around.
Yeah, and it's like, I can tell you your devil name. You must say your devil name, and then he says it, and then the thing disintegrates, and then all of a sudden his horns grow, and the fire with the crown in the middle of the fire happens.
Isn't he supposed to be big, stupid, air quotes, pun, the right hand of the devil or something? Doesn't he say like that?
I don't know. So it doesn't really matter. But it's like, yes, you're the devil thing now, and you are what you are always meant to be. Now open the door. And he goes,
he's an otherworldly doorman.
Package for you.
Top of the morning to you, sir.
So he goes and he walks towards the monolith thing, and he looks over at Liz, and this is the reason why he's doing it, because he's going to open the gate, and that'll bring her soul back. And he does one of them, and then throws him a rosary, and he's like, remember who you were? And it's like, oh, I can't.
And Rasputin's all like, don't worry, nobody will be sad when this world has been destroyed. And he's like, but the world's going to be destroyed, but you're still going to bring back my girlfriend, right? Like, sure, those two thoughts are not in conflict with each other.
Yeah, and so then he yanks his hand out of the thingy thing and breaks his horns, and then the light flickers out like it's some sort of poorly connected light bulb in a socket, and then the squid disappear, and Rasputin's like, no, my plan, you don't know what you've done. And he stabs Rasputin in the tum-tum with the part fragment of horn. And then he's like, you have no idea what has happened, and then his head gets all morphy. The squid monster comes out of him, and he's like, unleash the god.
You just reminded me, we didn't talk about the really bad CG hand when he squishes the CG Red Bull can.
Yeah, well, we also didn't talk about the Samael's that are the onset Samael's and the Samael's that are not the onset Samael's.
You mean the onset Samael's where it's just clearly like a dude in a suit swinging a big rubber hand that's like 6 feet too long?
Yeah. It's pretty obvious that there is someone inside of a animatronic suit covered in latex on a set, and then it cuts to CG.
The CG looked a lot better.
I'm going to say yes, but it didn't... What bothers me is the... it doesn't look the same as the onset. So the onset... and the CG look so different that you can always tell which is which, and I would have preferred it if it was more cohesive, where you couldn't tell the difference between the two. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, like the reason the Red Bull can hand sticks out, aside from looking, you know, the texture looking kind of CG, it's a darker red too. Like, why did you not even get the red colors to match properly? That's kind of weird, guys.
Yeah, like the Samael's don't have the same contrast as the onset Samael's.
Right, it's like they took the CG and then printed them onto negative and then optically composited it with the original.
No, I mean, they didn't, but I think they just let it get away from them on making those shots look cool and contrasting those up, whereas the onset shots were not as contrasty for the onset Samael's. So they look a little more filled in and like a, I don't know, milky white in the shadow areas, whereas the CG ones kind of fall off to darkness pretty fast, so they don't quite have the same appearance, let alone the motion. But
yeah, he's very bad at jumping physics, as noted by Blade 2. But speaking of falling off to darkness, you got Belly Squid.
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe because the horn went into the belly, and the horn was from Devil Land, and the horn had squid DNA on or something.
He had made a line. He said something earlier about bringing something back with him when he was talking to the professor before he kills him, and you see,
so that was like his plan C, was he had a squid in his belly in case he died. It's like his dead man trigger on the bomb, like there's a squid in my belly if you try to kill me.
Yeah, because like you see the back of his hand and when he's talking to professor guy, and the back of his hand has like this writhing tentacle movement underneath the surface of his skin, like, you know, CG of the era style. But it's implied that there's something else that came back with him other than just himself, and we see that later on. Now, I don't know if the horn like triggers that, or his death triggers that, or what specifically about that was the deal. But it also doesn't seem like the squid monster that comes out is particularly robust, because what kills it is like 10 grenades. Whereas
it cuts off a lot of tentacles with a concrete sword or whatever.
Yeah, that also makes no sense, and I'm very upset about it, because he just like it's like, I'm gonna take the sword from the statue. It's like, that's not how that would work at all. The sword would totally be broken, because it's not like it would only be connected at the hilt. What kind of statue maker would do that?
Maybe this statue was made out of metal. They put a real sword in there for realism.
That doesn't make any sense, but whatever. It's his crazy mausoleum.
Knowing the logic of this movie, it's probably like a demon knight frozen in time or whatever. So it probably wasn't a statue. It was probably just like an actual knight with a sword.
Yeah. Also, it was a giant sword, like unwieldy, like Final Fantasy VII Cloud sword.
Exactly.
He's slicing up tentacles left and right, and then he does the grenade thing, and the thing blows up, and that's it.
Oh right, no, but he blows it up from the inside. That's how he defeated it, because he got eight. He got eight with the grenades and blew up.
Yep.
Which kind of makes you wonder, like, what does it take to kill Hellboy? Like, we've learned that he's fireproof on the third rail, which also is a like a hint for later when he starts making out with Liz and she sets them both on fire, which is like, oh, look how cute. They're both on fire. But like, you know, you eat him, you blow him up with grenades, you set him on fire. None of those things kill him. Like what kills the Hellboy aside from, I don't know, the acid blood bitey thing on his arm hurt or something, but.
Yeah. Well, apparently you can cut him and stab him and stuff and he bleeds. and you can punch him and that hurts. But
we just needed Rasputin to say, do you bleed?
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah, Rasputin. You could do it in the voice. You could say you will.
Before we wrap this up, I'm going to ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what else Ron Perlman was also in?
You're going to say a Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Did he play, like, a Klingon or something?
No. Worse.
Romulan?
Close.
You're never Gabrielin? I don't know.
You will never guess it. He played the Riemann Viceroy in Star Trek Nemesis in 2002.
What the hell is a Riemann Viceroy?
Exactly. The movie's god awful, but that was 2 years before Hellboy. So I just felt like I would mention that. God, that movie is so bad.
Did they put prosthetics on him? Because he's got a fair amount of forehead real estate for putting things on.
Oh, Dan, you have no idea. I want you to look up Riemann Viceroy on the internet right now.
Oh, man, he was in the Beauty and the Beast movie.
No, the TV show.
It was a TV show?
Yeah.
Eek. I'm scrolling through his IMDb.
That was what he originally, that was his big thing. Linda Hamilton, I think?
Something like that.
Yeah.
I like Ron Perlman. I don't. He's in Drive.
Yeah. He's in Alien Resurrection. Remember that?
Oh, that's right. He's in the scene with the basketball and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he's friends with the Amelie director guy or whatever. And he was in The City of Lost Children.
Did you say Nemesis?
Yeah. Star Trek Nemesis.
This is him in the bat face?
Yeah. The Nosferatu makeup. Isn't that bad?
This is stupid. Why are they wearing these outfits in that thing?
Yeah, Dan, that movie makes me so angry. You have no idea.
Flame on the side of your face.
So angry.
Yeah, that would make me angry too. I'm just looking at that still image. I had to scroll past it. That's pretty bad. Let's see if there's another one in here. Anyway, so yeah, he blows up the squid, and then Liz doesn't have a pulse. And then he whispers some very romantic words in her ear, apparently, that says, like, hey, somebody who's dead on the other side there, don't make me come in there, I'll beat you up.
He's like, you better let her come back, otherwise I'll open up a portal on the other side and come at you guys, and then they do.
And you won't be happy, and that's romantic, so let's make out now.
Yeah. Kind of dumb.
Pretty dumb. Is that literally the last frame of the movie? They don't go back to the Department of Tasty Pies together, do they?
No, I think that's it. And then we get the Jeffrey Tambor thing in the credits.
Yeah, I missed that because.
Yeah, no, we've discussed, but yeah, I think that's it. Until Hellboy 2, Golden Army.
Yeah. Oh, he was in Blade 2 also. He's got some very, what is this hair? He's got a mustache that connects to some very thin sideburns.
Uh-huh.
Also connects to a small line of hair that goes around the back of his head.
Yes.
It's like one of those like strings that you clip to your sunglasses so they don't fall off your head, but it's hair.
It's what keeps his mustache on.
It's what keeps his mustache from falling off in the ocean. You don't want to lose your mustache running on your friend's boat bouncing around on the waves.
No, no. So anyway, Ron Perlman's been in some weird stuff.
Goodness, Hellboy 2. Yeah, when we were talking about doing this, I said, I don't really get it, but I'm willing to give it another try. I still don't get it.
No. But hey,
it was fine. You know, some of the humor was amusing. It's just a super like unbalanced movie in terms of like a narrative.
Yeah, and it's not a situation where you'd be like, oh, the director had trouble executing what the writers were doing, and the writers disagreed with the director because it was written and directed by Guillermo del Toro, so he knew what he was doing, and he was his own person to disagree with.
He's one of those writer-director folks too for most things, isn't he?
I believe so. I mean, he prides himself on that, but I just feel like that leads to some unbalanced stuff where, maybe if you had someone else involved where they could be like, hey, you know how you have this thing here? you know, it doesn't connect to this other thing here. Maybe you should make them like not be totally separate things from different movies. Maybe you should just have like sort of a through line or something.
Well, there was a fella named Peter Briggs who was co-credited for Screen Story, who has two credits for writer, one of them being Hellboy, one of them being Thunderbirds Are Go.
Oh, ow.
So those are all the credits he has. So that was the other fella spell-checking the story, the Screen Story.
Yeah. Well, also, this was a Columbia Pictures movie, so...
I don't know what that means.
Sony.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Means minimal competent oversight.
Well, you know, I like Perlman and he's red and he's got horns and stuff, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah, he certainly went the extra mile to inhabit the role.
And you've got Abe Sapien, the sausage king of the ocean.
That was a good reference there, Dan.
Thank you.
But yes.
I'm going to type it into the Slack bot right now. Slack bot. What did I... Show bot.
Okay. You ruined the moment.
Thank you. Yes, and.
Yes, and we're done.